Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. The first article is News and Reviews, conducted by Cody Grivno and Bryson Sleppy. Blueford Shops N-Scale Mill Gondola. A 52-foot, 6-inch, 15-panel mill gondola with factory-dented sides is now available from Blueford Shops. The injection-molded plastic N-scale model, offered with light, medium, and heavy denting, features metal wheel sets, body-mounted couplers, and railroad-specific end and hand brake options. The Blueford Shops model is based on a design developed by the Erie Railroad and Greenville Steel Car Company in 1940. From the mid-1940s through late 1957, mill gondolas were constructed to this plan by other builders, including American Car and Foundry, Bethlehem Steel, Mount Vernon Car Company, and Pullman Standard. In addition, Chicago, Burlington and Quincy, New York Central, and Rock Island Shops built this style of car. The sample we received is decorated as Conrail 522738, part of the railroad's 522584 through 522681 series, broken. The full-size 1,761 cubic foot capacity car was built for the Erie by Greenville Steel Car Company in April 1954. Following the 1960 merger between the Erie and Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western, the gondola became Erie Lackawanna 16520. The car joined Conrail's freight car fleet in April 1976. Construction of the N-scale model consists of plastic sides and ends glued to a die-cast metal floor. The sides feature three levels of denting. What's the difference? Quote, the lightly dented versions have multiple deflections in the side sheets above the floor line, end quote, said Craig Ross, owner of Blueford Shops. Quote, the medium dented versions have the side sheets visibly puffed outward between the rivet lines as countless small dings to the inside faces accumulated and stretched the sheets into rough domes. The heavily dented versions also have the puffed out panels, but to a greater extent. Plus, many of the ribs have also been deflected outward. The concave dent detail on the inside faces matches the convex outside faces, end quote. The gondola is offered with railroad-specific ends and brake equipment. The Conrail model has fixed dreadnought ends, an Ajax brake housing, and the same company's IP80 brake wheel. The floor has board detail that runs perpendicular to the sides. This reasonably captures the look of wood planks and Armco steel freight car flooring. The Conrail car had a wood floor, as indicated by the quote-unquote W on the sides. The bottom of the model features center sill, crossbearer, cross tie, and stringer detail. Parts of the AB brake system cast into the underbody include the air reservoir, brake cylinder, control valve, levers, brake rods, auxiliary and emergency reservoir pipes, and brake cylinder pipe. A plastic casting consisting of the draft gearbox, body bolster, and center sill stub is attached with a pair of Phillips head screws to both ends of the car. The 70-ton solid-bearing trucks are pin-mounted. The paint on our sample is smooth and evenly applied. The lettering is opaque, and the small data is legible under magnification. The quote-unquote E in valve was missing from the release valve stencil on both sides. I compared the model to prototype drawings provided by Paul Tupachevsky, Erie Lackawanna Railroad Historical Society Modeling Advisor. Most major dimensions match up. The interior width is a scale 6 inches too narrow, which is typical on open-side cars. The truck centers are 43 feet 9 inches compared to 43 feet 3.5 inches on the prototype. I was unable to locate prototype photos of the CR522738. However, images of the gondola from 1976, when it was still EL16520, are available online. The Wine Railway Appliance Company Lading band anchors were omitted from the top cord on both sides, but that would be a tricky detail to recreate in 1:160. The root boards were also missing. To see how the car performed in an operating layout environment, I took the gondola over to our Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy State Line route. The 4x12-foot island-style layout features 18-inch minimum radius curves and number 6 minimum turnouts. The gondola ran without issue while being pushed and pulled in a train. Kudos to Blueford Shops for thinking outside the box and releasing a factory-dented gondola. Though the model is plastic, the interior and exterior denting looks the part. I can see this model being a springboard for some cool weathering effects. Signed, Cody Grivno, Senior Editor. Facts and Features. Price, $37.95. Manufacturer, Blueford Shops, P.O. Box 152, Blueford, Illinois, 62814, blueford-shops.com. Era, 1940s to 1990s, varies by paint scheme. Road names, Conrail, Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, Erie, Lackawanna, Great Northern, New York Central, Nickel Plate Road, Pittsburgh and Lake Erie, Rock Island, and St. Louis, San Francisco, or Frisco. 6 road numbers per scheme, 2 each per level of denting. Features: 33-inch metal wheel sets, correctly gauged, body-mounted couplers at correct height, minimum radius 11 inches, weight 1 ounce, 0.1 ounce too light per National Model Railroad Association recommended practice 20.1. Next up is a quick look at Menards HO Cripple Creek Seed and Feed. Price, $24.99. Manufacturer, Menards, 5106 Menard Drive, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, 54703, menards.com/trains. Era, 1930s to present. Comments. Cripple Creek Seed and Feed joins the ever-growing lineup of HO scale structures from Menards. The factory-assembled model measures 4 3/8 inch wide by 3 1/4 inch deep by 2 7/16 inch high. The Menards HO scale structure features laser-cut siding, multi-piece window and door assemblies, freestanding corner trim, and a separate loading dock. The dock is detailed with a figure and an injection-molded plastic pallet. All 4 sides of the building have advertising signs. Brands include Dad's Root Beer, DeKalb Corn, Dutch Boy Paint, Mastercraft Doors, Purina Chow's, and Sinclair Gasoline. The logos range from the 1930s to the present day. The roof consists of an MDF deck topped with plastic molded to look like corrugated metal. The plastic, weathered with various shades of rust paint, has etched vertical and horizontal seams. Rake boards are attached to the sloping edges of the roof. A static grass mat is attached to the top of the plastic base. The mat is further detailed with shrubs, rocks, a pair of 55-gallon drums and fertilizer bags, and Jack the German Shepherd. Static grass fibers are applied to the bottom of the corner trim to simulate ivy. The building, unlike many other structures from Menards, doesn't have lights. Whether used as the standalone structure or part of a larger agricultural complex, Menards HO Cripple Creek Seed and Feed is a versatile building that will add visual interest to your model railroad. The ready-to-use model can be purchased at your local Menards store or through its website. Signed, Cody Grivner, Senior Editor. The next article is Preserving Model Railroad History. Making notes inside models helps provide provenance for future owners. By Troy Bassessi, photos by the author. I have hunted for antiques and collectibles over the years. From old phonographs and projectors to motion lamps and, of course, model trains. One thing I always wondered about was how an item may have ended up where it was when I ran across it. I retired about 4 years ago, and the construction was well underway of what will most likely be my last large layout. I was unpacking items that I had stored, waiting for this final build. In some instances, items had been packed away for more than a decade. One in particular started me on a path I hope will encourage modelers, both young and old, to follow suit. A simple magic marker billboard. Gil Stovicek, an O-scale master modeler from Lyndhurst, Ohio, operated a large O-scale layout in his basement called the American Central, featured in the February 1972 issue of Model Railroader. Gil scratch-built many O-scale locomotives and won awards for his modeling in both the United States and Canada. Although Gil was a serious modeler, he maintained a sense of fun and humor in his hobby, as evidenced by a billboard that read, quote, "Help stamp out HO," end quote. To be sure, Gil had an appreciation for all scales and his friends were wide and varied. When Gil passed away in 2003, his collection was boxed up and sent to auction. There was one thing I wanted for sure, that billboard. To me, that billboard was Gil. More than 100 people showed up for the auction. I put our gang on the hunt during the pre-sale review. We searched box after box, but there was no sign of the billboard. It seemed as though the billboard might have been considered worthless and had been thrown away. But then, a few weeks later, I got a call from a friend of mine, Bruce Barron, who had been at the sale. He had won several boxes of equipment, and what did he happen to find buried deep down in one of the boxes? Amazingly, the billboard. That billboard sits today in a prominent position on my Erie Shore and Ironton layout. It's there, certainly not as a slight to HO modelers, but to pay homage to Gil and his sense of humor. Preserving the history. When I finally unpacked the sign for display on my model of downtown Columbus, Ohio, I got to thinking that although I knew the story behind it today, it might not be the case for someone else in the future. With that in mind, I wrote a small history on the back of the sign, thus establishing its provenance. This then reminded me of other items I had obtained over the years. I have several buildings from the famous O-scale layout, Railway of America, by Mac Lowry, built in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, back in the 1960s and into the 70s. Mac and his layout can also be found in the September 1955 and August 1974 issues of Model Railroader magazine. So, I started to develop a pattern to attach a history to those as well. So now, both with items I know the history of and some of the buildings I've built, I block out an area on the bottom or hidden on the inside in white paint where I record in ink where the item came from, what model railroad it was displayed on, the actual city it was in, and any associated dates. For my items, I record the date built and the two or three model railroads it sat on. I keep the writing small, parentheses leaving as much room as I can for future modelers, close parentheses, and then give it a light spray with clear varnish. Since these notations will not be exposed, this should be sufficient. How you do it really isn't the point, but you may certainly bring a smile to the face of a modeler someday in the future when they find the notes. On locomotives and rolling stock, noting history right on the item would not be realistic. However, if the box is still around, a simple note card inside can cover it. While provenance is often associated with dollar value, that's not what we're trying to do here. It's for the fact that it might be interesting for future modelers to know where an item came from and what layouts and cities it may have traveled through. Quote-unquote, value is subjective. Is there any real value in a simple magic marker billboard that may have taken just a few minutes to construct? My answer to that is a resounding yes. I have yet to tell the story of the billboard and not have it bring a smile to the person hearing it. These items, these people, and in this case, this humor, deserve to be appreciated by future modelers. Let's help that history avoid the trash. Establish that provenance and let those items tell their story. Troy Bassessi is a lifelong model railroader. He was a salesperson and consultant on paint coatings, products, and systems for nearly 36 years. He and his wife, Mindy, now reside near Ironton, Ohio. The next article is Ask Model Railroader by Cody Grivno. Any ideas for building a workbench? Question. Since Model Railroader magazine has moved to a new location, have you given any thought to a video or magazine series on building a workbench? I've got to build a new one to fit my new train room, and I'm looking for ideas. Signed, Jim Burns. Answer. Thanks for writing in, Jim. Our workshop space is pretty well set up at the moment, so I don't anticipate any articles or videos on that topic. As you may recall, the workbenches at our former Kalmbach Media headquarters were built into the room. At our new offices, we decided to use portable benches to make the shop spaces more flexible. In the modeling workshop, we have 4 adjustable height workstations on leveling feet. This allows staff members to sit or stand while working. We cover the work surfaces with tempered hardboard or a self-healing mat to prevent them from getting damaged. The modeling workshop has overhead fluorescent lights and large windows that let in plenty of natural light. Outlets along the wall provide space to plug in lights, tools, and computers as needed. In our layout construction workshop, we have Husky 24 by 52 inch adjustable height workbenches. The benches feature a powder-coated steel frame, a solid wood top, 2 drawers, leveling feet, and swivel casters with locking brakes. The crossbar support can be put in the middle or at the back. The height of the Husky workbenches is also adjustable. When using the leveling feet, the height range is 26 to 39 inches. If the casters are installed, add 3 inches to both numbers. Though we don't have plans for a workbench video or article right now, I did find some stories in the Model Railroader archive that may be of interest to you, including DMBM-2 Workbench, July 1984, Build a Practical Home Workshop, July 1991, Build a Portable Workbench, December 2000, Build a Modular Workshop Cabinet, April 2002, and The Model Railroaders Workshop, Part 2, July 2006. Next question. In your special issue, Best of Industries, Harold W. Russell wrote about the R.B. Crowell and Son Grain Company. He stated that the rail-served industry received grain in bulk loads, but in the photos and drawings, it seems to me that they would ship grain instead of receiving it. What are your thoughts? Signed, Marcus Russ. Answer. To answer your question on feed mills, I turned to Jeff Wilson's book, The Model Railroader's Guide to Grain, Kalmbach Books, 2015. He wrote, quote, "Rail operations at feed mills vary by their size. Large mills that produce pelleted feeds, as well as the plants that make premixes, will ship products by boxcar or covered hopper. Most local feed mills don't ship anything by rail, parentheses, their outbound traffic is to farmers and other end users, close parentheses, but through the 1960s, they might have received bags of premixes or pelleted feed by boxcar. Much of this traffic today arrives by truck. Feed mills don't often receive grain by rail. It's more likely to arrive by truck." End quote. Next question. When I was looking at pictures of the Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy locomotive fleet, I noticed small numbers near the Herald on some diesels. Were those numbers tied to the control system used on the layout? Signed, Jason True. Answer. Yes, those single and double-digit numbers near the Herald on MR&T diesels corresponded to the Power Systems Incorporated Dynatrol Command Control System that was used on the club layout. In the December 1989 Model Railroader, longtime staff member Jim Kelly wrote, Quote, one other very important development came in the early 80s. It was obvious that if the MRNT were to become an operating railroad, we needed to be able to run more than just one train at a time. We had begun wiring rotary switches and harnesses for 6-cab block control, but the task looked absolutely hopeless given our lack of manpower and zero enthusiasm for wiring. You may remember that commercial command control systems came of age in the early 80s. This development came to our rescue like cavalry charging over the hill in an old movie. We purchased PSI's Dynatrol system, and voila! Finally, we could run multiple trains. End quote. I recently emailed Jim to learn more about the significance of the numbers. He replied, quote, with the Dynatrol system, you could control up to 16 different locomotives with numbered red plugs about an inch long that were plugged into the controllers. A receiver could respond only to a controller fitted with the plug numbered for its signal. The small number on the cab indicated the number for the receiver inside and the plug required to run it. End quote. When the layout was switched to digital command control, some units had the Dynatrol equipment replaced with decoders. The small numbers were painted over on those locomotives. The next article is Step by Step by Lou Sassy. A flag for the Kingfield Post Office. After having my friend Rich Cobb build me a post office for the village of Kingfield on my On 30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes Railroad, I struggled with how to come up with an American flag for the building. I considered looking on the internet for examples of period flags and thought about how to copy them at the proper size and on what material. One morning, while pondering my dilemma, I realized I had a 1930s to 40s era American flag in my garage that my brother had given me years ago to display outside my home. Parentheses, between you and me, an O or HO scale, only you will know if the flag is the proper vintage. A more modern one will work if the number of stars isn't immediately evident. Close parentheses. I walked out into my yard that very morning, flagstaff in hand, and had my wife, Cheryl, photograph me holding the flag from about 15 feet away. Since I decided to hang my flag on a pole on a calm day, I held the pole vertically. Modeling the flagpole was a simple one-evening project that added prototype realism to the post office scene. I hope you give these techniques a try. Step 1. Making the flag. I returned to my computer, downloaded the photo, and printed it on copy paper at various sizes. I opted for a contact sheet size. It is shown in Figure 1, along with the rest of the materials and tools I needed. I took the printout to my workbench, placed the paper on a piece of glass, and used a fresh number 11 blade and a hobby knife to cut out the flag, see Figure 2. I carefully squeezed the flag to bend it and give it some dimension, while at the same time making sure the plain white side of the paper onto which it was printed didn't show, see Figure 3. Step 2. Building the flagpole. I made the flagpole from two sizes of brass tubing. The total height of the pole is 18 scale feet, with the top 14 feet made from 16th inch diameter brass tubing and the bottom 4 feet from 3/32nd inch diameter brass tubing. Parentheses. I actually made the bottom 8 feet long so I could plant 4 feet into the scenery base. Close parentheses. I cut the two lengths of tubing with my cutoff tool, Figure 1, slid the smaller diameter inside the larger, and secured them with quick-setting epoxy, Figure 2. I also slid a straight pin into the opposite end of the 16th inch diameter tubing and epoxied it in place in Figure 3. While I had the epoxy out, I added a small V-shaped bracket cut from a scrap of styrene strip to tie the flag rope to. I brush painted the pole Model Master 4679 steel with the Model Master line of paints discontinued by the Tester Corporation, substitute another silver shade. End editor's note. Step 3. Putting it all together. I applied some white glue to the edge of the flag with a toothpick and attached it to the top of the pole in Figure 1. Once it dried, I added a length of rope, tan button thread. After doubling the thread over, I ran it through some white glue between my fingers in Figure 2. This causes the thread to straighten out and at the same time allows you to glue it to the pole, I placed the still wet thread alongside the pole, pressing it into place as I did so in figure 3. Once everything had thoroughly dried, I poked a hole into the quote-unquote ground goop in front of the post office with an awl, pushed the pole into place, and I was done. Now the folks in Kingsfield are following government regulations regarding their post office, and it all happened in one evening. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@AfterSight.org. Thank you for listening.